What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show, season 3, episode 1. I'm back. It feels good. We have our first guest of season 3 with us today, my buddy Atlas, and his story is quite the story to tell. Beautiful soul inside and out. I have had the pleasure of becoming really good friends with him over the course of the last year, and I knew that I needed him to be on the show. I'm going to just jump right into it. I hope you guys enjoy, and I'll catch you on the other side. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Art of Storytelling, Tales by Law, and this is What's Your Story, Season 3. It's been a year, almost a full year, since my last recording. It's been a few months since the last two episodes of Season 2 came out, and here with me is one of my newest, like, brothers from another mother's. I'm so sad that, like, this pandemic has happened, because you're, like, one of the dopest people I've met in a long time. But my little brother from another mother, my man who puts the entire world on his shoulders, living up to his namesake, but give it up for Atlas. I don't know how to call you by your given, like, government name, and it's so weird, and I refuse to do it.
I have aliases, which I'm sure is something that we'll get into later, but my real name is Thomas Tufts. My maker name and soon to be legal name is Thomas Tusano. That's the logo I have blazing across my shirt. And as Law said, my art buddies call me Atlas for probably, I hope, reasons that will become clear later on in the episode as everyone gets to know kind of the story of where I am and what I try to do. So,
all right. So you were briefly telling me before this that you've been on podcasts before. Not only will you be featured in the Cascade Chronicles podcast, feature on Medusa's Cascade when that comes out, but you've been on a few podcasts.
Yeah, so I'm involved in a lot of makerspace stuff in the maker culture, which is, like, when you think that, like, Adam Savage and things like that. Mm-hmm. I worked with one makerspace in Detroit, did a podcast called Make Something Wonderful, where we featured different...
That's such a wholesome, lovely name.
And there's a story behind every little name and tag that I've got, but Make Something Wonderful was me and a guy named Matt Carpenter and another gentleman named Robert Burns.
Wait, is his actual last name Carpenter?
His last name is
he a carpenter?
No. And
oh, I was going to be like, that's so on the nose. That's amazing.
Matt was actually a vehicle engineer for Ford, or is a vehicle engineer of some sort for Ford, doing diagnostic and road testing. Okay. And he was part of the makerspace that I had been a part of for a while. It'll go unnamed for various reasons, but yeah. Either way, we had a podcast called Make Something Wonderful, because my grandmother's shop was Wonderful Things, and she had a handcraft store. So I was like,
oh, wow, okay.
They had some permitting issues. They had to shut down. Basically, a permitting inspector or whatever said that you're losing your grandfathering out of this one permit, which shouldn't be a thing. And we're shutting your building down, and they had to do, like, or shutting their store down, bunch of stuff. But they were like, after 55 years of being a female minority owned business, we're going to close the doors and retire. And wow. So they were like, yeah, you know what? City's going to give us trouble. And so I said, you know what? I would love to figure out a way to carry on the name of the store. Mm-hmm. And so Wonderful Things, I made the podcast to Make Something Wonderful, thinking that it was going to be around for a lot longer than it was. That was my brainchild, is get a different maker.
Are we going to get into why it's not a thing anymore? I feel like that'd be amazing. That sounds so nice.
So the reason why is basically, like, internal politics and community change within the makerspace that I was in. And
okay.
I don't want to dredge up any, like, you know, raw nerves or scars or whatever else have it. But basically, yeah. I was just like, I'm not doing this anymore because this reason. But my whole goal was to take someone from a different profession, trade, craft, artistic interest every week and have them on and talk about that thing as a way to have this sense of community and education and people talking about what they love to do. And we had like a list of questions that was meant to dispel common.
I'm gonna tell you right now, you yeah. might have to repurpose and like redo it. I know it brings up like such a
yeah.
but like such a good thing. Not to cut you off, I have like things from like, you know, shared memories with people that I used to, you know, that are no longer in my life, you know,
yep.
ex-girlfriends, ex-best friends, whatever the case is. And I would go to these spots regularly with them. And for so long, I deprived myself of going to those spots. It's like saying I don't go to my favorite restaurant anymore because that was a restaurant like me and my girlfriend had our first date in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's. I forgot who told me, but they were like, you can't do that to yourself because yeah. Are you going to throw away? I almost said a pair of boots. I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, roll with it. Finish your sentence, Law.
So
finish your sentence.
So it was like, are you going to throw away a functional good pair of boots when you know there's so much more that they can give you? Stop looking at me like that. Listen, I swear to God, I could go into a whole fucking hour rant on why we need to burn those. Yo, I guarantee all the spitballers who are listening to this are just fucking hysterically laughing right now because they know I want to go ham. They know I'm like ready to fucking roast you so bad.
All right. For some context real quick, I have a pair of old Tims I used to wear in high school that I kept, and they are millennia old.
Oh,
customized
God.
Tims. The
poor dawn of man.
Yeah, the poor things look just torn apart, and I still use them to get mail and start my truck in the morning, and these guys roasted me for them. That's the truth. That's the story. That's why we're laughing, is because they spent an hour and a half roasting me about these shoes.
Oh, my God.
Simply because I refused to throw them away.
So, essentially, going back to your podcast, I think that from what it sounds like, it has a lot of good in it. Like it had a lot of purpose and meaning. And I've known you long enough that I know that what you do and what you put out in the world is with good intentions and your full heart and like passion. You want like to impact people in a positive way.
Yeah.
I think by the sounds of what little you've given me with that podcast, it's something that we all need, like community, especially in the art community.
Yeah.
It's not a rare gem, but it's like a very precious gem.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, if you can have it, hold on to it. If you have to repurpose it, it's like having an old wedding ring and being like, you know what? I'm going to like smelt it, make it a nice, you know, brooch or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And absolutely. Like I do have something written in the stars to be a spiritual successor to that. And that's also why I'm involved with Sin Shop in Las Vegas, Nevada. I do a lot of things with a gentleman called the Mighty Pong. And that's
Pong.
Just his screen name.
Oh, man. I was so sad. Like, as soon as I was like, all right, I think I'm ready to like jump on his podcast, he was like, yeah, my computer shit the bed. And I was like, oh, no.
He'll still have you. He loves guests. But Pong is still one of my best maker buddies who is involved in tech and code and making real quick for those people who don't know maker, like makerspace and the maker movement.
I was gonna get into it because you've been talking about you know makerspaces and creation, but
yeah.
I don't think you know, for people who don't know you, what do you do? Like, what is your art? What is your craft?
Let's start there. I am a multimedium, normally wood and metal, most known for wood, craftsman. So I do a woodworker is my area of expertise. I dabble in blacksmithing. I'm at least proficient. I wouldn't call myself an expert by any stretch of the means. But
is it bad that I immediately thought proficiencies and like expertise like
D&D? That's exactly where I drew that vocabulary from.
Oh, okay, just making sure.
So, I know your audience. So, so more or less, I realized very early on in life that the trades were my talent. And that was like where I was meant to be. I had a mechanical mind or not, or a spatial, a kinetic mind rather than.
You needed tactile, like things yeah. to be held and okay.
Yeah. Curves and textures.
How far back then are we talking, like middle school, maybe even earlier?
So what would happen is I would, yeah, like a lot, like, let's see, during the summers and late and or like May, starting in April, May, my parents owned a gas appliance store. My father was the East Coast Hank Hill. My mother was like, oh no, I'm not even, I will show you.
Oh no.
I will show you a picture.
Oh man. Okay.
And we'll get into that. But my mom was responsible for helping assemble gas grills. She was, she is incredibly mechanically talented. She has a letter of congressional recognition for breaking the gender barriers in trades, specifically for gas fitting. Because this was the late '80s, I want to say. So this was the early to late '80s where my mom got this
letter. Which is an even huger accomplishment, like, you know, than it was like, you know, in the, like being in that it was in the '80s, that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. So she has this congressional letter frame sitting somewhere, basically, you know, congratulating her for getting her, her licenses and all this other stuff. And so she would assemble the gas grills and she would sit out with me and give me like the basic assembly. Like, so she would do all the little intricate stuff and then she'd hand me the frames and I'd sit there and I'd zip them together with a ratchet to the point where I got to 15, 16 and I would be doing things like I would loosen one bolt with the tool, get the bolt I just loosened with my next hand and move on to the next one and be able to take something apart in like seconds.
Okay.
And know it like inside now. So I had like a mechanics mindset. Mm-hmm. And that came very early on.
A tinkerer mechanical mindset. You like knowing and understanding how things are made and how they work and how they function.
Yes. But I married that with art because I'm very kind of like a romanticized person. I romanticize a lot of stuff. So I like very simple machines and very like, okay. But aside from all that, that's getting way off the track. It was bad enough.
Listen,
that
by all means, I've so you gotta understand, like there's been episodes we've done where like on any podcast that I've ever done, especially my own, like I've had like up to 2.5 hours, 3 hours, and like we'll start from somewhere, get to somewhere else, and then if we are lucky enough to backtrack to that one thought that started us there, by all means, you know?
Yeah.
But just go for it.
All right. So okay. So in high school, I show this mechanical inclination. My brother was rewarded, patted all the time on the head for being academically smart, for math, for sciences, for whatever else. And
how many siblings?
I've one blood sibling, and then four step siblings, and then two or three siblings, maybe four, like a handful of what I call family by choice.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yep. So my blood brother though, Timothy, so there's Tom and there's Tim, my younger brother, had the academic intelligence, math, science, all doing algebra in his head, no problem. But me, however, the teacher started looking at me like I was eating lead paint because they knew that I was smart and that I was well spoken, but they just kind of like, we don't know how to engage him properly. And then eventually I started failing language classes like Spanish and Latin and things like that. Like I was interested, but I was more in the mythology and the cultural aspect and not the language. And so they, and we'll get to that changed later on. And I actually found out I have my aunt's tongue for languages, but that's later. That's a lot later.
Would you consider yourself one of those kids who like in conventional, like today's society, like we have kids that go to school and they do the, you know, 3, and it's math, science, this history, and it's very by the book. But then there's also classes that are very, I want to say unstructured, but they almost have a practicality in how they teach. Like they're very like, you know, This is why this whole, you know, train of thought started, and this is why we know, you know, history the way we know it, or we know art the way we know it. Like, would you be on that latter side?
Yes. And the other thing is that, and this kind of is baked in my character later, as far as it goes, is I believe I was failed in high school. I believe that the system didn't really do much for me and for my intelligences. And then I had to scrape back that time spent that I should have had to develop in my teens, in my early 20s. And that sucked. Because I still did okay, but then you look at everyone who had that head start and you're like, well, look at where they are in life. And I'm at 29, just starting off where they were at 22. And
it's learning later that, yeah, like, it's, yes, they failed you, but I feel like, especially in American, like, schooling is made to teach, to memorize and test. Whereas, you know, like, I've met some of the smartest people I know in a room are people who dropped out of college, who just go and experience life experiences, like, for the sake of just, yo, I went and I backpacked and I did this, and I went and I just packed my bag and just left. And it was just like, oh, like, wow, like, well, how did you learn this? I just picked up my YouTube and I, you know, started taking some online classes. Like, when you have a choice in what you learn, you're so surprised by, like, what you do retain.
Yeah. And that's, well, and it's also, I agree with you, but one of the things that I did and that I focused on after I got out of high school was cracking that system for other people like me, because no matter, until there's a wide societal change, and this is like one of my, like, ride or die, this is the mountain I will die on, is that the education system needs to be cracked open for kinetic, spatial, mechanical learners, because this is like, it's so bad. Like, it's so, and I'm lucky, Law, because I mean, I'm sorry, look at me. Look at, like, I have things that are, I think we had a discussion about this. I have things that are just granted, that are given to me, that are not given to others, and that it needs to be cracked open for other people, because if I'm being forgotten and if I did this, it must be two or three or four times as bad for someone that doesn't have the privileges and the things that I might have been set up without realizing I had. Right. And so that's my whole shtick, is like, we need to crack open education and change the model.
Absolutely.
I'll always revert back to that platform and being vocal about it when anyone gives me any sort of soapbox. So
I'm here for it. Do you mean to backtrack you where you were?
I need to kind of go back to where I was before.
So you were saying that in high school you were this kind of tactile kinetic learner, but school failed you, but you realized later on, like, you know, what kind of student you actually were.
Yeah. So I failed out of my language classes. The school looks at me and says, we're putting you on something called an individualized education plan, an IEP. And they said, we're giving you 2 years of shop classes, and it's an intensive. So they replaced two periods of my day, a day, with shop class, to keep me engaged and keep me out of trouble. Okay. The shop teachers, however, realized that I was super talented, incredibly witty and outspoken. And they're like, what do you mean this kid's a problem student? He's our favorite kid when he's in our classes. Like, my drafting teacher had me. I was quiet. I was reading. I was trying my best to do my drafting assignments, because drafting was basically math and drawing, which are my two worst things in the world. But I did the work for him. I showed the interest in what the topics were. I learned the terminology. So he was like, cool, just, you know, catch up on these assignments and I'll pass you. I took small engines, metal fabrication, wood shop, and advanced wood shop over 2 years of school.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And the other cool thing was, the wood shop teacher loved having me, is because all the kids who were, like, this was in the early days when influencers were just starting to become a thing, and, like, you know, people who were doing really cool stuff. Like, so this was 2008 to 2010 range, when stuff was really,
I got
social media was just starting to really come up. And so I was doing some cool stuff, and these kids were like, oh, look at this senior, look at this junior senior. He's like building guitars and building speaker cabinets and building things that function and that's relevant to our interests, because like rock stars and all this other shit. And like, you know, so he's doing this really cool stuff. And they would like crowd around my bench and talk to me about what I was making and like what I was trying to do and design and what I wanted to have out of these things. And it would keep the kids who really had discipline problems, who like, you know, they were hyperactive and their parents refused to medicate, or they came from a bad home or whatever else. It kept them busy. Like, 'cause they were like looking at me like going, oh my God, this is so cool. You can apply everything from building a birdhouse to building a guitar. Like, that's insane. And so these kids like started following me around and like respecting me, because in shop class, I was on their level communicating between the teachers, like what the teachers expected and what we, you know, like what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my element. And that was where like my whole personality came from, is shop class. That's where it was. So I graduate high school. I'm looking for something to do for the rest of my life. And I was incredibly interested.
You're still on the East Coast at this point, right?
Yep. I'm still on the East Coast. I'm just south of Boston in a town called Easton. My mom divorced my dad and then moved away to Providence. And I followed her about a year and a half later.
Okay.
I want to say. So I was still in high school. I was finishing up my senior year in Massachusetts, but I was commuting from Rhode Island every day.
Oh, and
that's,
wow.
That's 40. It's like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was commuting either from Rhode Island, or I was staying with friends in Brockton, Bridgewater, and some of the other towns surrounding that.
Is that how you started hanging out with the crew for the most part? Getting to know these guys?
A little bit. Nyung was Bulletproof Turtle Man. He was a friend of a friend at that point.
Okay.
And I knew of him. I knew of his art. I really loved it. And I was hanging out with that friend. Yes. That, you know, that friend that knew him more directly. So I graduate high school. We're spending, you know, you spend your early year, when you get out of high school and early kind of college years, you know, palling around a lot with your buddies. And so I was going to Brockton, hanging out with Ed and a few of my other friends. And I was really into guitar. I was sunk. I grew up on 80s rock, on Van Halen, Journey. I got to see a few like 80s bands as it was the tail end of the
stage. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Like, 'cause I don't know if people know, but rock, like, hair metal and rock started to die, like go down this downward slope where stadium shows aren't a thing anymore, unless you're like AC/DC or Motley Crue, one of the big draw popular classic rock bands. So stadium shows were going down the tubes. I saw Van Halen on the tour where Wolfgang accompanied him. Either way, guitar was my thing. Like throughout high school, that was my identifier. And so I went to Georgia for a 6-week intensive in building guitars. And I came back and knew how to build an electric and acoustic guitar from scratch and had the practical experience. And then I started trying to figure out.
Do you still have the first guitar you ever built?
I have the two kit guitars. I sold the first electric I built, and I have the first acoustic, and I can make pictures if you want to throw them up on screen at a later point.
Okay.
And I was sitting there like, I didn't know what to do, because a six week intensive to me in my late teens, early 20s was a big deal. But to a luthier, which is a guitar builder who's been doing it for years, it's like, kid, you've barely scratched the surface. There's repair techniques. There's lacquer touch-ups. There's setups and intonations. There's neck resets. Like, you've built two from scratch. You know your geometry and your structure, but you have no idea when you're dealing with a finished beast how to take that thing apart. Right. And I did a little bit. But there are more complicated repairs that come with time and knowing the things. So I was basically unemployable, is what I'm getting at, as far as my dream career went.
Okay. But at that point, the seed was planted, essentially.
Yeah. At that point, I had the shop knowledge. I had something to fixate on. I had something I knew I wanted to do, and a place that I knew I wanted to be. And I got into I started doing hobbyist blacksmithing and things like that to kind of blow off the stress of trying to find this path, trying to make something of it. And
is blacksmithing and woodworking something that typically goes hand in hand, or you just kind of found yourself going that way?
I found myself interested in bladesmithing first, and then from there I started realizing that it has practical applications for woodworkers. So I then wanted to learn more of it to flavor my woodworking and to add my own accents and to know how to weld, how to hammer, how to forge weld, how to do all this other stuff that came along with it. So I got into, and I started dipping into different trades and started picking up different pieces of mechanical knowledge. And then I started falling into different rabbit holes about making. And I haven't, like, I kept hearing the term making rather than blacksmithing, rather than woodworking, rather than, and I just heard making, and I'm like, what the? And so I start, you know, trying to figure out what this whole thing is about. And then another one of my buddies taps me on the shoulder, says, hey, they've got a furniture design program at this college I'm going to. You should sign up. And this college that he's talking about was the Rochester Institute of Technology in Western New York. And I look at that place and I'm like, dude, I'm a solid like 2.5 GPA student. And you're asking me to go to a school that's $55,000 a year to get a degree that may not, like, I don't know. And he's like, just try it. They've got an excellent program. It means you can be with us. And I go to the school and I was right. I tanked out. But it wasn't because I was a bad student. It was because the art program there was structured towards traditional mediums. And they made furniture designers draw. And so I found out right quick that the 5-6 years that people had spent in art class, that they were going to a industrial design program, they knew that they were going to have to draw. Whereas I was like, let me draw you a rough idea of what I'm going for, and then let me sculpt my way to my end goal, was how I viewed furniture making.
Gotcha.
And they said, no.
Are you still kind of like that with the creation process even now? Like, you have a very rough guesstimate of what's going to go on, and then as the process goes, you kind of let it come to life.
Yes. And a lot of people now, and I see the communication value of that and the application of that, and I find myself in disagreement with a lot of craftsmen who are like, draw first, draw a plan first, do this, do that. And I find myself at odds with them a lot. And it's mostly because miscommunication.
I would be more inclined with where you are, because I feel like you still, to some level, all crafting and all making has that foundation in art. And art is subjective, and art is something that you should be passionate about in doing.
Yeah.
To whatever degree.
Yeah.
So if you are not having that freedom to kind of pour a little bit of yourself into your craft, it kind of feels like very sterile. And it's just like, meh, you know, because you can put something on a machine and let it spit out like 100 duplicates. But a lot of the imperfections that you get from you making it and you bringing life into this otherwise lifeless thing is something you're not really going to get.
Yeah. And now I will make an argument towards CNC and towards some other things later, but the point was that they looked at me and basically went like, no, you have to draw, you have to communicate your ideas through visual medium and 2D medium rather than 3D medium, because we don't, the only way we know how to assess you is through 2D, like, it's through it 2D.
Like a them problem.
Yes. So I left.
That's like someone giving me a cookbook and being like, cook this. And I'm like, no, I know the general idea of what I want to make, and I'll like midway through like cooking, I'll figure out, oh, this is what I'm making. Cool.
Yeah. I think someone said it was like, it's some form of Slavic cooking. I can't remember which culture, and I'm sorry to any of those listening, but they said add onion, paprika, and garlic to a pot and then cook whatever the hell, like you'll figure out what you're making at the end or whatever. So
it, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Add your sweatables or your whatever your starter, your seasoning vegetables, and then figure it out. That's kind of how I go. There are other things again, but that's where my head's at when it comes to design.
Right.
I have to backwards engineer things, I kick myself then, but I backwards engineer it to make it repeatable after I've figured out what the piece needs to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So either way, they said like, well, you're not going to be able to do much here in our furniture design program. So what are you going to do? And I spent a semester or so, or my second semester, trying to do a multidisciplinary program between the arts and the humanities, because I was like, there's a link here. There's some loose philosophical link between psychology, the humanities, and artwork. And I started to see I started to see the vague outline. This is when everything started coming into focus, like the vague outline of what I was trying to do. And then my friends took me to, and this is where I dug in and I found my niche, because my friends took me to PAX East. I don't remember what PAX East it was. Okay. For those not in the know, PAX is the Penny Arcade Exposition. It's a massive game design show, like a trade show.
Oh yeah, it's like a mini E3.
Yeah,
that's like the best way to put it. If you know E3, it's E3 on a smaller scale. But even to frame that, it's like saying Australia as a whole versus New York City. It's that kind of comparison.
Yeah. So they dragged me to PAX because RIT is the number two gaming design school in the country, only followed by Worcester Polytech.
Wow.
Yeah. So they were, RIT has a huge presence at PAX East, and they're only 8-9 hours away from it. So of course, basically the game design department looks like a ghost town during PAX.
Naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my friends go, dude, you should come down to PAX. I'm like, but what about, and they're like, no, don't worry about it. So I go to PAX East and I make a chance encounter, with who will turn out to be my deontological opposite in every sense of the word, Doug Costello. And the reason that name comes out of my mouth and says virtual is I won't try to defame him, but I don't appreciate his thinking these days. He is the CEO and one of the founders of Wormwood Gaming.
Okay.
And Doug offers me a job. Because he's like, oh, you build guitars. And this is at the PAX East booth. I'm like, yes, sir. He's like, okay, bet. You live in Providence, right? He's like, meet me at a Dunkin' Donuts in Taunton. And we're going to discuss, like, we're going to do an interview.
What?
Okay. And so because he figured out the halfway point, me and Doug talk. And this was like through text or through phone calls later on. But I'm like, okay, cool. And so I signed up and I passed the interview and I end up working for Wormwood Games for about 2 or 3 months. And I realize I'm not in the right headspace. I'm trying to go back to college. Doug is very much like, no, don't go back to college, just stay and work for me. And I'm like, but I have a question I have to answer. I have something I have to figure out. So I'm going to head out and I'm going to, you know, like, I appreciate it, but I have to go. And now, around this time also, I had been hustling my ass off doing community college classes because I dropped out of RIT because $55,000 a year isn't tenable when you're a furniture designer or a humanities student out of state living on a, you know, I'm like, no, this is getting a little too pricey for me.
Yeah.
So I drop out of RIT. I go to Community College of Rhode Island. I do classes there. I start looking further. I take all my gen eds, all my humanities classes. I load up. Every semester is a 17 credit hour semester for me. Oof. I'm doing 15 to 17 credits.
I do not envy you at all.
I, I did that for a year and a half to, I lost track. It had to be a year and a half to 2 years. I just piled on every class I could imagine, from Italian to my math, got my gen ed maths out of the way because I was like, I never want to have to take another math class in my life. I take my humanities, my English classes, my psychology classes, a couple business courses, anything I could get my hands on. I was hungry for it. And I must have left there with the max allowable transferable credits to a 4-year institution. It was,
Wow.
I think the max that the next school would take. They're like, what's your goal school? I'm like, I don't know, but I want to make sure that I have to take as few classes as possible to get my 4-year degree.
Right.
And so I do that. And I eventually start looking out west. This is when my eye starts turning back west.
Okay.
And my friend group falls apart because of this unknown, this drama that I won't hang out people's dirty laundry,
right.
But it came out to my friends wanted to focus on having fun. I wanted to start focusing on my career, and there were a couple people starting drama, and I was just like, I'm done. I'm done not being serious about my career because I'm already behind. I'm behind the eight ball because of the way my head works in this society. So I'm like, I'm done. I'm working hard. How do I make sure that I focus on the next thing? And yeah. I made sure to tell all my friends, like, listen, bud, it's nothing against you, but I want more for myself. And they finally, over about a year to 9 months, they kind of came around. They're like, okay, we get it. You're not going to be happy here. You're not going to be happy where there's no opportunities for you. And you've not necessarily scorched earth your industry, but there's no other game in town when it comes to what you want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, okay, so what are you going to do? And I visited what at the time was a friend in Detroit. And that was my current girlfriend, Christina.
Oh, you guys go way back then.
Oh yeah. This was 2015. Is 2014, 2015. I knew her
since like forever ago.
I met her I graduated 2010. I met her 2012. So we've known each other.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
And when my friend group fell apart, the people that I then fell in with were Christina and a couple others. And this is when Young started being a bigger presence in my life. This is when the Spitballers came around, because when I was in community college, Young started doing the December Speed Paint Massacre.
Gotta love it.
This is when Young does the first December Speed Paint Massacre. I think this is the history. Now we get into the history of the Spitballers
a little bit.
And so he does the first or second Speed Paint Massacre, and then he realizes that there's a bunch of friends that are going to either do it with him or enjoy what he's about. And so then he starts a Discord, and he posts a Discord link up on his Facebook. And I'm like, oh, cool, another post from Young. What's this? And I click it, and mobile Discord installs on my phone and whatever else. And I'm like, okay, cool, follow this through. And I end up in the middle of a chat room. And I'm like, like that Vince Vega from like, I'm like, what is this? And so
just lost Tron Travolta.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, this is, and then Young sees me like kind of stumble in. He sees all the notifications like, oh, someone entered the chat. And he's like, oh, hey, what's going on? This is like where all my artist buddies are going to hang out or whatever else. I'm like, okay, cool. Peace. It's like, what do you mean peace? He's like, you do art, right? I'm like, yeah, I do woodworking. Like, you guys all draw. What am I going to have in common with any of you? And so you know how hilarious
you poor naive child.
So I stick around because eventually I'm like, dude, these guys are cool. Plus they're drawing pinup models. Plus they're drawing like a whole bunch of badass stuff. And I'm like, this is awesome. So
we got, at this point, how many Spitballers are there?
There is the originals. There is Khan, Doc, who else? Let me click over to this other window and see the roster and see who is around. Khan, Doc, Nyung. I think I was one of the originals. Who else? Maybe Kimbo. Kimbo was so quiet that I don't know if he was a part of it from the get-go.
Okay.
You guys just joined. Yeah, I think that was it was Khan, Doc, and someone else who are the ones who are still around. And then there are some that are quieter that might have been around, but those like Khan and Turret were the two most CERN and Young were the two most active as far as anything goes. And I was always there cheering them on because I loved their designs. I loved Turt's badass artwork and I loved Khan's storytelling. And
100%, yeah.
Yeah, and I was just like, okay, cool. This is, and they kind of used me as like a guinea pig, and I would post what I was up to from food to woodworking to whatever the hell else I considered art. And they were kind of encouraging of this. They were like, hey, this is all valid. This is all artwork in some sense. It takes an eye for composition, takes an eye for sculpture, it takes fine hand movements to make any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So they were like, keep going.
You poured some stats into, you know, some point stats into dex, into intelligence, into, you know, charisma. Gotta get the performance up high.
Yeah. So either way, you know, so that's when that happened, or that's the concurrent timeline. Like, what else is going on in the background of all this?
Right.
My friends are like, Detroit. Like, they look at me like, Detroit, really? Like, because you have to remember, this is off the 80s. Like, we all grew up with the 80s, 90s image of Detroit.
Yeah.
And they're like, dude, like, are you, like, what's out there? And I visit. And at this point, getting the lens removed from this pop culture image of Detroit, from this topical image of Detroit, like, really got me excited about it, because I saw these old brick houses. I saw these wonderful communities. I saw, you know, small businesses. I saw, like, the place was crawling with potential. And I looked 100%. Around. I'm like, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, are you crazy? Have you taken a second glance? Because the right entrepreneur in Detroit could do a lot. And not just necessarily for themselves, but, like, for other things. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to save up money. I'm going to work for my mom's boss part-time.
Okay.
And I'm going to save up. And I saved up $3,000. And then I started applying to colleges so that I could have a time to familiarize myself with the area before I dove into doing anything else. Okay. I applied to a school called LTU in a single weekend. And what I mean by that is, their admissions were closing in 2 weeks to a week. And they were starting their semester very shortly. Like, they were starting their, like, I left Friday and I got there in time to sign up for my classes Monday, 15 minutes before classes started.
Like, whoa.
Yeah.
What?
Yes. Because here's the reason why I had been in communication with their humanities department and said, hey, I want to do something really wacky. And they're like, what do you want to do? I said, I want to prove the link between craft and the heuristics built, like the neurons and the pathways and the ways of thinking built between that alternative intelligences, self-esteem, and kind of this alternate way of thinking about things and approaching things. Basically kind of multiple intelligences and how it, like, the confidence you build up from doing these things can translate, and the difference of communication. So there are all these different interesting anthropological concepts buried in the exchange of doing something and thinking, like abstraction and doing was what it was typically coined as.
Right.
So there's the separation of thinking and doing, where I don't think there's actually separation. I think it's the same thing is what I wanted to get at. And so they're like, okay, cool. So what kind of things are you going to read, and what kind of things are you proposing, and what are you doing? I said, I want to do a practical, as well as taking some of the more artistic and passionate sides of humanities. So poetry, literature, psychology, and things like that. And take a practical look by actually submitting pieces that I made, that I woodworked, that I sculpted, that I designed, that I whatever else, and talk about them, you know, like talk about the thought and the process talk about the abstraction that went into making them as I was.
Fascinate me as a human being, sir. Yeah. Like, that's awesome. Like, that is, you literally just told people, like, hey, not everyone is designed to be, you get a classroom full of kids and you go, everyone go play baseball, and get mad at the kids who can't play baseball well. And you're like, maybe they're not baseball players. You can do them on a track and field, of course. You can throw them, in a music class, and they excel so much more because not everyone is designed to have the same skill sets. That's what makes us unique, and that's what makes us so, uniquely dope, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just like, this is what I'm out to prove, because this is where, and I started digging, and I realized that people had been making a case for a long time, but it was an unsubstantiated, unscholarly case, because people had, like, there's Matthew Crawford, there's Nick Offerman, there's Peter Korn, and there's a couple of, I think, Richard Sennett. But you look at these books, and they're written not necessarily by pulp fiction authors, but they're written by people who don't or aren't given academic weight. Like, let's take the instance of Peter Korn, for example, who I got to have a brief conversation with him. Like, very, very brief. He runs a school in New England that teaches furniture building. Okay. And no one has heard of what he does, his research, or his books, because he basically started off counterculture. He started off in, like, the free love, like, that was his, where he grew up, and, like, the 70s, 80s. And so he was a very counterculture cottage industry figure, and he never got into the mainstream. Okay. Nick Offerman is, everyone knows him as Ron Swanson. Like, everyone. Naturally. And so you view him as this actor, but you also don't know that he runs Offerman Woodshop. Mm. Like, he has a whole woodshop out in California that people don't know about, where he employs people who you, like.
That's right. I didn't know about him with woodworking. I knew that he took a particular interest in whiskey or scotch, like, recently. He has his own distillery kind of thing.
Yeah. And so you think of him as an actor, and you don't think of him academically at all, or even having this authority beyond being Ron Swanson.
True.
So, and Matthew Crawford is a fringe, I'm not going to say he's like MLM or kind of schemey, but he kind of talks about, like, fringe intelligence. And he's talked about a lot of things. He's tried to legitimize things, or tried to legitimize ways we think about certain things, in a very controversial or non-academic light. Like, he's tried to do what I'm doing, and he's tackled topics that people haven't been thinking academically on. So therefore he's kind of hand waved away. I realize that all these people, like, this may be a fruitless effort, but there are people who have been writing on it and people who have been doing it, is what I'm trying to get full circle on. Right. Is there are other people that are trying to do this, and I'm not going to say I gave up, but I don't have the academic weight. I have a 4-year degree. I don't run in anthropological circles. I'm not a movie star. So at that point, I thought about it. I said, what authority do I have?
And how old are you about at this time?
I want to say I'm 25 to 26 at this point, and I'm 29 now.
Okay.
So I was very promising at LTU. I was normally the golden boy of the humanities department, because the humanities department was five 10-foot by 10-foot offices down a single hallway.
Oh, wow.
So, like, all the professors knew me by the time I graduated, and I was there 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, so all the professors knew who I was and what I was up to, and, like, and they tried to involve me as much as they could. So I did have some academic weight. But at the time, that was only for that one school.
Mm.
And that was it. And I was also, like, I was also working through a lot, being in a new setting, away from home and all this other stuff. So I only had the capacity to focus on my schoolwork and not go advocate. So my schoolwork I viewed as advocating for this.
Okay.
And so I didn't have much room to do much else. But I did get myself involved with something called the De Quindercut Freight Yard. And that was, this is probably my crowning jewel and one of the things I'm most proudest of. An opportunity came up from my film professor, because I was still taking some oddball electives when I was
film at art. Professor?
Yes. I took an introductory to film editing that required us to shoot.
Really? That's... What?
It was introductory to film.
I didn't know you dabbled in editing.
I did not love it. I still don't love it, but I appreciate it.
There's no in between for editing. I would say this, like, this is my mountain that I would die on. This is the hill that I would die on. You either enjoy editing, like there's a therapeutic process for you, or you hate editing. No matter what. So like for me, I don't like doing photography editing. That's why most of my photos, I try to get in camera and do very light, like, you know, brightness, contrast, little stupid bullshit like that. Video editing can be daunting. So there's times where I look at stuff and I'm just like, why am I still here sitting with like the same project for like 4 hours for like a 20 minute clip? Like, you know what I mean? But I enjoy it more than I would photography. But I know that there's certain projects that, like, if you told me to do certain projects, I'd be like, no, I'm not editing that. Because I would pay someone else to edit my own work just so I could just shoot, send it to someone to edit and be like, edit this in what you would consider my style and then give it back to me. I'll throw it up.
Yep.
All day, every day. 100%.
Yeah. So either way, that's what that class turned out being, is absolute hell. Like, I love the subject matter we covered, but it was absolute hell.
What were you working on? What was your editing program? Do you remember?
We were working in Premiere.
Okay. I never worked in Premiere, but for a first time, I know that can be kind of daunting from what I've heard.
Yeah. So I scraped together what I had and leaned on the strength of my narratives. It's all shorthand for, I deleted every video I made
after. Damn it, we can't go deep in that shit.
No, that's not.
You can't find it on the interwebs in somebody's basement somewhere.
There's 1 hour-long documentary left that was supposed to be my thesis capstone called The Magic of Making on YouTube. And it was a horribly edited together job.
Do you have the raw footage still?
Somewhere. I can get you what I used. So we can trust me. This is okay.
I'm willing.
We'll come back to this because it'll all come back around.
Okay.
So I joined up with a cause that I really believed in through my film professor, because my film professor is a guy named Stephen Coy, who has something called the Hygienic Dress League, where he goes around and he does wacky art installments all over Detroit, like wacky, like rebellious art installments. And like things like men in suits with animal heads, like some deer hunter level shit. Like it's
okay.
Yeah. But I mean, he's a super cool guy. Like, you talk about those people who spend like 2 years backpacking around the world and, you know, doing very, very odd things. Steve Coy was the embodiment. Like, he had like the 70s cop mustache with the aviators, and he was a great professor.
Please tell me he had full luscious flowing hair and wore like the biggest not fitted button up shirt.
Well, it was like here, and it was, yes, he wore like cheesy Hawaiian button down prints. Like, It was
chef's kiss. I love it.
Yeah. It was Professor Coy, if you're out there for some reason listening to this, I loved your class. So I loved your teaching style. I loved your class because he was like,
stranger things have happened. I've had people who I've never met sell me that they've heard of my podcast and they listen to my podcast.
Nice.
Did I ever tell you that story?
No. I want to hear this now.
I did. So I did a really quick. Sorry.
No. Go for it.
So I did a career day for my friend who is a teacher at an art school for kids, and she had a girl, a woman who worked at Nick as an executive producer or whatnot.
Yeah.
My buddy Marquise, who I only just met there, but we instantly hit it off. He was there. He's a talented actor, writer, producer, rapper, singer, like the whole artist shebang. Then it's me with, you know, the million of other things that I do. So there's a lot of, like, she comes from the executive corporate side of art, like art corporate, and we're like the freelance trying to make our passions a reality kind of, you know. So we instantly hit it off. Mm-hmm. Turns out we were all leaving, we're about to like go grab lunch or what have you, and his wife Leah goes, "What's your podcast?" And I was like, "Oh, I have a bunch of them." "No, like, what's your personal one?" I was like, "The Art of Storytelling." She's like, "I think I've listened to that." And I'm like, "What?" Like, never in a million years. And sure enough, I showed her. She was like, "Yeah, I've listened to this before." I was like, "Dope. You guys want to be on the podcast?" So I think they're like season 2, episode like 3 or 5, something like that. But like, it was so surreal. I was just like, I gotta have you guys on, because their story, if you guys go listen to that, is such a beautifully interesting like love story and passion for the arts, and they're awesome people. I love and miss you guys. But like, it was bonkers. Continue, sir. Continue.
All right. So where was I? Oh, my film professor and his project. He's teaming up with a family who owns a series of restaurants throughout Detroit. They're called the Cooleys. Phil Cooley, his parents, and his family, they're involved. The family business is more or less starting restaurants, and they own the most famous barbecue spot in Detroit called Slow's Barbecue. If you look it up, it's famous for having like lines out the door.
I've heard of this, and I feel like I've only heard of this from like my friends who go to like, so I have a buddy, Lou, who like lives in Chicago.
Yeah.
But, like, when they all did, him and my brother do like baseball tours, like to go, you know, baseball, stadiums all around the country and stuff. I think they wanted to go there. They were like, the line was just astronomical.
Yeah.
But they're all foodies. Like, we're all 100% foodies. And like, oh man.
When this is over, Slows. Yeah, Slows.
I will camp out. I would camp. I would listen. And you could ask any one of my friends. Tone, ask Tone.
Like, yeah,
you can bribe me with good food.
Yeah,
easy. Oh. Like, there's you can be like $500. I'm like, nah, yo, this food is banging. Like, top 5 best food you're ever gonna have in your entire life. And I'm like, I'm here for it. Let's do it.
Well, look up their menu and tell me you're not instantly drooling.
I'm gonna do it right now.
Okay. So either way, Phil and Professor Coy, they decide that they want to do something good for the city of Detroit. And they've been working for a few years with these students. And I'm gonna wait for you to see your reaction here. For the audio listeners, screw the audio listeners to see his.
Oh no! Why? What are you doing to me?
Kiss that size 25 waistline goodbye.
Oh man! What is that?
What are those?
All right.
I think one of the subs, one of my favorites, I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly, was a Korean-style pork belly with, like, jalapeno or something like that. Maybe I'm misremembering, but it's a crazy fucking sub.
What the fuck did you just say? Like, hold on. So I'm looking at, like, stuff like, what? Wait, time out. This sandwich is called The Genius.
Yeah.
Tender plant-based morsels tossed in Slow's classic barbecue sauce, topped with coleslaw and dill pickles. I don't even like coleslaw and dill pickles, but that sounded very oddly sexual just now.
Yeah.
Just say it. I'm mad. So like the menu is like one page, super simple. And I'm like, that's what gets me. Cause here's what happens. Lines out the door.
Yeah.
4-star review. It was the first place I looked up as I was Googling. It was like, this is the place. And reasonable prices. So you know this is like a dive kind of spot that's like a staple. And those are like my favorite places. Like the spot.
You want to know what makes it 100% better? Is there's a place literally like right next door called Sugar House. All right. And Sugar House, if that name is even vaguely familiar, it's because it is one of the bastions in the Northeast craft cocktail movement. And it has some of the best and the most hard to find spirits in some of the finest mixed cocktails you'll ever have. I had a Manhattan made with
this place looks amazing.
Yeah.
What are you doing to me? Like we have a podcast that's still recording.
Hold on real quick. I a birthday a couple years ago, I had a Manhattan made with a Japanese whiskey, and instead of sweet vermouth, it was made with port. And it was beautiful.
How?
Because port's a dessert wine.
It is. It's so I'm not mad. I'm not mad at it. I'm less like, not so much that I'm mad at it. I'm mad that I haven't had it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because Tommy, our bearded DM, or one of our bearded DM buddies. So Tommy, when I went up to Maine to visit him, like maybe 2 years ago now, him and his wife took me to this like very like speakeasy kind of vibes, but it wasn't a speakeasy, but it was very like crafty, smoked everything with a perfectly shaped ice cube. So we're just like, what?
Yeah.
Like it was amazing. Probably the best drinks I've had in a long I think it's presentation more than anything. Because I feel like if I had it at home, I'd be like, oh, this was good.
Yeah.
But those presentations make it it's amazing. You can do no wrong.
So either way, I was involved. So okay, to circle back, Slows, Sugar House, this Phil, my film professor. They get involved with this project where they're like, we're going to build a place for local entrepreneurs in Detroit to come and sell their wares, sell their, you know, so like streetwear and sell like handcrafted stuff and whatever else, and build like a marketplace, because Southwest Detroit is full of amazing entrepreneurs that have no outlet, no marketplace to sell, because these are the disadvantaged communities. Like I'm trying my best to be PC and sensitive, but this is the best way I can put it is, and it is, it's just the fact of the matter. It is what it is. So we're working with these kids from Southwest International High School. Okay. And that was one of the high schools in Southwest Detroit, obvious. And they took some of their most promising students and they were like, hey, you guys are going to be working directly with these kids from Lawrence Tech, which is the school known for my school, known for designing like cars for the big three. Like it's a farm school for the in-house designers for the big three automakers. That's what LTU is. I didn't know that till I got there. I didn't know about that side of LTU until I roomed with, like, my roommate while I was in the dorms there was a first year auto design student. And like, I was like, oh, dude, this is crazy. One of his first assignments, and this is the coolest thing I've ever seen, was to take a car and design a land speeder from the Star Wars prequels with it. His first assignment was to pick the lamest car in existence and design a land speeder around it.
If it wasn't like the Chevy Nova, then he's doing it wrong.
I don't know. I think he drew Toyota on that one, but that was the wacky shit though. The auto design students got to work on. I was like, wait, what? You guys get to do that? It was crazy. It was so cool.
Do you know why the Chevy Nova didn't sell well in Mexico? This is a legit story.
I thought you were setting me up for a joke. No,
no. What was going on? I heard it in a joke and I thought it was a joke. So I looked it up and it was true. So in Spanish, no va means no go. So they, you know, put this car out, the Chevy Nova or the cases. And in Mexico, people are reading it like Nova. Oh, this car doesn't go. We don't want it.
Yeah,
because it was so directly trans, like on the nose, that it was just like, nah, we don't want it. Like, this car doesn't work. Like, why are you selling us a car that doesn't work?
And even if it underperformed, then of course all your buddies are going to be laughing at you because it's right there on the nameplate. So why would you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I love it.
But either way, just like a certain pair of boots, your buddies will be conning on you if you wear it. But. Listen, I can clown on myself. I can do that.
So there was like 3 points of the podcast so far that I had the boots in the back of my head. They're kind of like the nightmare of legends. And it was just creeping. It was just like, ha, he, ha, he, ha. And I was just like, I could bring it up into conversation again, but I'm gonna let you live because apparently they're keeping you alive for some reason.
Yeah. So anyway. So I start work on this project and it eventually evolves to where the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy gets a hold of us and our program. We pitch them, we become clients of the city of Detroit through the Riverfront Conservancy. And the Riverfront, so these are the guys that run the Riverwalk, which by the way was just voted America's top Riverwalk, which is fucking crazy when you think about it.
Yeah.
So either way, we got that. And then there's another thing called the DeQuinder Cut, which is where something called the Grand Trunk Rail Line ran through, which the Grand Trunk Rail Line was the timber barons. They were bringing trees into the city to be processed or to ship or so on and so forth. So Grand Trunk Rail Line cuts through the city. After years and years and years, these trenches, like the concrete rivers you see in California, this is pretty much what it was. And so the Riverfront gets a hold of these trenches where people had been dumping shit for years, cleans them up, turns them into a greenway, and connects them to the riverfront out near the Wren Center, where the Detroit River separates Canada and America. So they created this network of greenways and walkways that go through Detroit, which is awesome.
Right.
And then they're like, we have some spaces along the DeQuinder Cut that need to be activated in an urban designer sense, which basically means we need activity there.
Okay.
So they looked at Eastern Market and a couple of the other landmarks around that area. And they said, right about here, it's the perfect distance from Eastern Market to be within walking from parking. And there's still like necessarily nothing there at the moment. So if we put something there, it would push the activity a little further out. Like it would expand what we're already seeing to liven the city up a little bit. So they do that and they drop the DeQuinder Cut Freight Yard there, which is a series of shipping containers that you can host events out of and the Riverfront will rent out. And then there's also an organization that will work with artists and artisans and handcrafters and entrepreneurs to bring them into these stalls that they purpose built into the freight yard to be able to sit out there and sell stuff. Like,
that's really dope. Like that is like community building at like its core. That's awesome.
So I got to be part of that project and it was then where I started taking that potential that I saw from my initial visit in 2015 around that time and started really being like, okay, I can't just be another white guy that comes into the city and says, I see potential and be, you know, this hipster who's going to raise property taxes and gentrify. No, that's not what I'm about. Right. There's an active community here that needs to be emboldened and encouraged. And I don't care what you look like or where you're from. If you're putting capital in to the city, be it either through sweat equity or through money or through investments or time, whatever you're putting in, you need to be respectful of the community that already exists there and have whatever you put in be symbiotic with the community. Right. And that was my major lesson learned from that entire project. And through that project, I got to do a couple great things with an organization called Pony Ride, which was Phil Cooley's collaborative co-working space.
Okay.
Adam Savage eventually visited Pony Ride. I wasn't there for that, but I wish I could have been. There's a video.
So dope.
There's a video of him talking with Phil, so you know this person isn't just made up.
Right.
Like, so Adam Savage got to meet Phil, which I was really jealous about. And through Pony Ride.
He's passed us at con dressed up in his cosplay at New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
So, like, I found a video of it online of him either passing the booth or passing one of us. It might have even been me, but like I like we saw it, and it was when he did the it might have been when he did No Face from right. So he passes and we're like, oh, that's so cool. It was either No Face or something like to that effect, you know, one of his grand cosplay designs for NYCC, and we passed, we're like, oh, that's so cool, that was that third. Later on, months later, when he finally does the reveal, I share it to the guys. And I'm like, he was at the booth! Oh my God! And I'm combing through, and we barely see, like, one, I think it was one of us, or like the booth itself. And we were like, oh, that's us! That's us! That's so cool!
Yeah. Adam Savage is absolutely my hero and the perfect example of how to be a good ally in any community, and how to use one's platform and know when to step aside and out of the way and let the work speak for itself and how to be excited about it.
Adam, if you're listening to this, if this ever crosses your ears, we are huge, huge, huge appreciators of what you do and who you are. We love you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, working with Pony Ride, working on the Quindercut Freight Yard and doing all this other stuff, you know, I graduate, I move on from that project, I show my family, I talk about it, and during I think the tail end of my studies at LTU, I get involved with a makerspace in Ferndale, who again shall go unnamed, but either way I get involved with them. And I become really active in their community. And I then realize what making is, what it's about, what kind of like this, it's kind of almost like freedom of information and like, you know, education.
Did you always feel like you were on the cusp of the information, like of knowing what it was, but you still weren't on the inside, so you didn't get it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's how it kind of, and then I met basically a bunch of crazy, I would, they're not anarchists in a dangerous sense. They're more for free and open exchange of technique and all this other stuff, like of information of how they did this. They're enthusiastically share everything and push for a lot to just be open and out there. Open source everything, proprietary, nothing, like, you know, all this other stuff, you know, make what you can, buy as little as possible, like that kind of mindset. You know, so crazy, you had everything from crazy redneck engineering to, you know, someone's rooting their iPhone so that they never have to pay Apple ever again kind of shit. Like, it,
oh, wow.
You know, like that kind of stuff, using laser cutters and CNC fab to figure out how to make things that normally people would just buy and all this, like, really, really crazy stuff. And I get involved in that community, and I actually go to the Nation of Makers convention, and I see, like, how the rest of the country does it. And I realize that the context that I got used to making in wasn't the context that was the tone for it. And what I found out is that makerspaces these days try to fit their either corporate incentives from companies who are very industrialized. Okay. So like DeWalt, Google, a lot of the high tech or industrial companies will have makerspaces as employee incentives, or they vary on the other side to being startups and things like that.
And welcome back. That was part one of me talking with Atlas and figure out what his story was and sharing that with you guys. I am so very grateful to not only him, but all of you for listening and for him for sharing his story and having a season 3 to come back to. This has been an incredible journey, and I am so excited to keep sharing these stories with you guys. Stay tuned, follow along, and I hope that you guys enjoy. As always, follow your path. Peace.